gap and create a circular shape. Parts of the existing trellis will be replaced or repaired. In sports, the World Series begins tomorrow night with Tampa Bay meeting Los Angeles. The Dodgers wrapped up the National League pennant last night with a 4-3 win over the Braves. With things having gone so smoothly over the first four games, Aaron Rodgers says he figured the Packers were in for a dose of reality, and that's what happened yesterday with a 38-10 loss to the Buccaneers. Meanwhile, the Bears hung on to beat the Panthers 23-16. The forecast from the National Weather Service, mostly cloudy today, a slight chance of showers during the afternoon, a high of 51. A slight chance of rain showers this evening. Don't be surprised if you see a few snow flurries mixing in, a low around 35. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, continuing with scattered showers as a possibility. Tomorrow's high 51. Expanded forecast for midweek Wednesday, partly sunny and warmer with a high near 57. Right now, 33. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays 11 till 5 and Saturdays 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Greg Reberg. It's always a special pleasure for me to be able to speak with outstanding documentarians about the work that they do. And I certainly am happy to be connecting today with an Emmy Award-winning documentarian by the name of Ben Loderman to talk about the next film to air in the PBS series American Masters, and this one devoted to Walter Winchell, a really quite unique figure in American history, at least in some ways, although his legacy remains very much with us to the present day. And certainly Walter Winchell helped, in a sense, open the floodgates for much of what we experience now. Walter Winchell had a way of blending the worlds of news and entertainment in ways that had never been seen before his rise to prominence in the 1930s and 40s. And he was someone who had a very popular column and a very, very popular radio program as well, briefly dabbled in television as well, and was someone who had an enormous influence on the American public. And his fall from grace, if you will, was a rather precipitous fall. And much of what he represented, as I said, is very much still with us and in many respects as robustly as ever in our cultural landscape. All of this is explored in this marvelous film, which is titled Walter Winchell, The Power of Gossip. And Ben Loderman is the writer, producer, and director for this fine, fine film. Ben Loderman's previous work includes such films as 1913, Seeds of Conflict, The People versus Leo Frank, Public Enemy No. 1, and Rescue at Sea. In addition to Emmy Awards, he is also the recipient of the Media Spotlight Award from Amnesty International. Once again, this latest film in the American Masters series is titled Walter Winchell, The Power of Gossip. Ben Loderman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Happy to be here.
Really, I'm really, really pleased to be talking with you. I'm just thinking about this, and I wish I'd taken 60 seconds to try to look up a list of some of the illustrious sort of artists that have been showcased on PBS's American Masters over the years, because it makes me kind of wonder what Walter Winchell would think of being included in such illustrious company, since so much of his life and career was devoted to kind of a desperate search for being taken seriously in ways that perhaps he never exactly was. Can you just speak to kind of the interesting place of Walter Winchell on the list of those who have been showcased in American Masters?
Well, like you, I can't list all of American Masters' great tributes to artists, ranging from Toni Morrison and Miles Davis to Bing Crosby and Bob Hope and Lucille Ball and many of the people, Mark Rothko as an artist. And I think the territory of American Masters has tended to be over time, with the rare exception of a sports figure like Martina Navratilova, or even a publishing magnate like Joseph Pulitzer. American Masters tends to find those masters in the world of arts and culture and music and dance. And so it was, I think, a particular challenge to be given the task to say, take a look at Winchell, because I don't think the series has ever been known. And I think Winchell may be its very first master SOB. I mean, he's not a likable guy. And I had trouble as a filmmaker finding ways to stay with him over the course of the couple of years it took to make the film, because I tend to like my characters and find ways to sympathize with and empathize with and understand them. And Winchell, though he is Jewish like me, though he is in the media like me, is not an easy one to understand, and I think he would not be the only one surprised to find himself showcased on American Masters on PBS. I think there are many who would be appalled, and maybe many who will watch Tuesday night and be appalled to see Walter Winchell on American Masters.
How much did you know about him and his story before you undertook concerted work on this film?
Very, very little. Well, I'm embarrassed to say. I'm 64 years old and want to think that I have to go to people closer to 10 years older than me to have any personal recollection of even being a child in the house where Winchell's voice was heard on the Victrola or the radio in the house, and often at no older audience than that. So my reason for doing Winchell originally had nothing to do with him in name. It had to do with trying to look at the landscape of what's going on now in our politics and in our media. And I confess that with a 32-year-old and 29-year-old child who have very divergent views, I often find myself trying to make my films increasingly for them, to say something to them or to answer them about what's going on. So they grow up and live in the world of social media, and if we want to go, if anybody can scratch their head and remember that name of that old media Peyton John Stewart, let's say, or Rush Limbaugh, you know, those are names that my kids may know. But Walter Winchell, not at all. And I must say not at all either, except that my mom loves to say every time she hears his name to give his signature sign on about "Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, let's go to press." And that's a reaction that I've gotten from an awful lot of people when I mention the name Winchell.
Hmm. You know, in some ways, in a sort of sly little acknowledgement of the fact that so many people now either do not know this name at all or only very vaguely, a nice way to kind of encapsulate just how important he was is the fact that your film starts with a few amusing moments from one of the most popular television programs in the early 1950s, in which Walter Winchell is what we would call a celebrity guest. Explain the show, which I suspect a lot of our listeners are acquainted with, and in a sense, why this is a nice way to start your film.
Well, it's both a cliche and something done very consciously and on purpose to start with the television, iconic television show, What's My Line? It's actually hosted by a very affable host, John Daly, who much earlier in his career worked as an assistant to Walter Winchell, of all things.
Wow.
So what people will recall when they tune into our film is the opening sequence, which is, of course, is in black and white film from 1952, and of course includes some of Walter Winchell's contemporaries and rivals on the panel. So it doesn't take them too long to figure out that the mystery guest, because they're all blindfolded, is Walter Winchell. But it takes our audience, I would guess, a lot longer. And at some point, we acknowledge that fact very late in our film.
We're speaking with Ben Loderman, who is the writer, producer, and director of the next American Masters film, a documentary which is titled Walter Winchell, The Power of Gossip. One thing that's interesting about your film, and I appreciate this fact, is that you tell us not a whole lot about Walter Winchell's earliest life, his childhood, but you tell us enough to kind of give us some sense of how that was indeed a springboard to who he would ultimately become. Tell our listeners what you think is most important for us to know about his earliest years.
His name. His name is Winchell, and his family changed it to that from Winchell when they came over on the boat in the late 80s, like so many Jews fleeing Eastern Europe. Now, Winchell was born actually just after the family moved from the Lower East Side of New York, which was a teeming, desperately crowded place. It's not the kind of place you would want to have COVID, let's put it that way, to a new enclave called Harlem, where Jews were just coming to around the turn of the century. And Winchell was born in 1897 in Harlem and drops out of sixth grade to be a little song and dance man with a couple of friends. He's singing songs and trying to sell the sheet music to them as intermission between short films at his local cinema. He graduates from that into a little song and dance routine and into what we know more familiarly as vaudeville, and a troupe of young people run by someone named Gus Edwards. After that, he was off and running on the regional and then national vaudeville circuits, and realizes pretty early on he doesn't have it to cut it in there. He's not going to be a star like his friends Eddie Cantor or Georgie Jessel. So he does something else.
I think it's so important, and this is one of many things I learned in your film, but I had no idea whatsoever that Walter Winchell's background first was as a vaudeville entertainer. And it really helps us understand why, even though he ends up becoming this writer, this columnist, who longs to be taken seriously as a journalist, even though he never does gain those kind of proper credentials, that part of his soul, he is always an entertainer. And everything he does from that point on, in terms of his writing and his radio work and so on, is really first and foremost about entertainment. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I think it's more than fair to say. And I think in less skillful hands, his career as an entertainer and a writer wouldn't have gone very far. You know, I just have to think back to the presidential debates where people are calling each other stupid or shut up or this or that, where you realize that Winchell, although he was often very hyperbolic, his reporting was often inaccurate, he was so skillful at being a wordsmith, at crafting phrases, as coming up with little sayings, that he had that special secret sauce that made him so popular and so believed. So he was really, he was a master in that sense and belongs on American Masters as a practitioner of modern gossip, the modern gossip column, in a way that we haven't always seen more recently.
Let's talk about Walter Winchell's emergence as a writer, as a columnist, and maybe clarify what it is that he created. I mean, what he did that was groundbreaking versus what he did that was a matter of stepping into something that already existed. I don't know if that question is very elegantly phrased, but it's not. What I'm trying to say is Walter Winchell did not create the world in which he operated then for the next two decades. That world, in a sense, already existed, but then he brought something maybe new to it. Can you help clarify that, if that question makes any sense at all?
Sure. Winchell came into the newspaper business at the moment at which there was a huge influx of immigrants to the country, many of whom didn't speak English well. There was a huge influx of women into the workforce, which was new, and put them onto subways and buses and public transportation. And all of this social history fostered the resurgence, because it wasn't the first time there had ever been a tabloid. But the tabloids took on a new importance in American society around the time that Winchell gets a job in 1924 at the Evening Graphic, one of the main tabloids in New York City. Now, what distinguishes tabloids from other papers is something that has nothing to do with Winchell. Tabloids are about pictures. They're about photographs. They're about a new thing that was going on that I can only compare today to, what do you call it when we digitally alter a photo? Photoshop, basically. Hmm. And those were then called composographs, so that they could take an Ernest Caruso and someone else meeting in heaven and publish a photo of it. You know, just outlandish pictorial portrayals of things. What Winchell did was he came in and he invented a Winchell-y, something H.L. Mencken, who's, you know, a noted cultural writer of his time, and who am I thinking of? Others say called Winchellese, okay? So that Ernest Hemingway called him, you know, a great linguist. What Winchell did was he talked about things being on fire when he was excited about something. He talked about people being welded when he was talking about a couple being a couple. He talked about people being a stork when he was talking about someone having a baby, giggle water when they were drinking liquor, you know, pashing around if they were fooling around, or having a feud, which he would spew out in lots and lots of letters. So I think what Winchell's claim to fame is in his time is inventing the colorful language he used. It's not that he did something so different than anybody else. He just did it better. Hmm.
You tell us that a real breakthrough for him commercially is when he goes from writing for, in a sense, a single paper to writing a column that is meant to be widely disseminated, and it is, and he becomes quite well known across the country because of that. Was this relatively uncommon at this point in time in the late 1920s?
It was completely uncommon, and what made it happen was someone named William Randolph Hearst. And Hearst became famous not so much for what he publishes, for how much he published. William Randolph Hearst was one of these mogul publishers who began to collect papers and began to buy up papers around the country. And one thing that happened when he did was they needed to consolidate, as companies do today when they form conglomerates, and they needed to spread the talent. And so suddenly, a paper not far from Racine or Kenosha could have a Broadway columnist because Hearst had Winchell writing for his paper in New York, and they would spread that around. And just like now people are concerned about Hollywood gossip, perhaps more than even Broadway gossip, that's what happened. In the course of it, the economics were not worked out, and they decided to incentivize writers to do this and allow this to happen, to have their columns be printed and reprinted and reprinted and reprinted in dozens of papers, by letting them keep half the proceeds of the syndication rights. So Walter Winchell very quickly in the late 20s becomes a millionaire, first of all, and second of all, becomes read in over 1,000 papers and becomes widely known, becomes a brand almost in the way that a byline never was in what we call print media or legacy media.
Hmm. Explain the nature of the gossip that Walter Winchell most often shared in his column, and maybe give us a rough idea of the proportion of gossip that would be rather negative or salacious in nature versus gossip that might be, in a sense, more benign.
Very negative, very salacious, very fun, a lot of sex. What Winchell did was he made public what others were afraid to print. So whereas before talking about Broadway or other stars getting a divorce, it had to be in the courts. What Winchell was famous for saying was that other columnists may print it, but I make it public. So it was that going first before something had been sorted out or codified in the courts that made Winchell so interesting. Now, don't forget, he comes to the fore just around the time of the Depression. His first job is in 24. He's kicking around for a couple years. He's doing what we call backstage gossip. Who's with who? Who's not performing? Kind of, as you say, very benign kind of banter. But pretty soon it ramps up. And as it ramps up, and as the Depression happens at the same time, people are looking for stars, for the glamorous, for the rich to get skewered. And that's what Winchell took on as his mission. So suddenly his humor, which was benign at first, becomes more biting. It becomes more socially important. And eventually, it cuts to the very biggest news stories there are.
Hmm. We're speaking with Ben Loderman, and we're talking about his film for American Masters called Walter Winchell, The Power of Gossip. One of the things that happens as Walter Winchell comes to prominence as a columnist is the Great Depression, which changes some of the sort of financial aspects of the business at this point in time. And this is one of the things your film tells us that prompts Walter Winchell to branch out into the world of radio. Explain the ways in which he took off as a radio personality and the scope of his popularity at the height of his fame.
Well, there's never been anything like it, and there probably never will be again. I mean, what happened was Winchell was becoming this fantastically successful and widely read syndicated columnist, and he tries his hand at radio, and he's a natural. I mean, he's just a natural, and he takes on a following that is hard to believe. And what he does is he just really reaches everyone to a point where if you're walking down the street in a major metropolitan city, you're hearing Walter Winchell on the radio. And if you're walking down the street and the windows are open, you don't have to change the channel. You hear Walter Winchell from building to building as you're walking down the street. I mean, he had just this phenomenal following to the point where even though what he was saying in his radio show and his column wasn't so important, he caught the eye of a new president, Franklin Roosevelt, who suddenly realized, this guy is so popular, I want to buy this his audience. And Roosevelt invites Winchell down. Unbeknownst to Winchell, he gets a call one night and is invited down to the White House to meet the new president. Well, you can imagine Winchell. I mean, he's this gossip monger. I mean, he doesn't think of himself as important. He doesn't take himself importantly. He relishes his popularity, but not his gravitas. And to be asked by the president of the United States, and basically they have a very quick conversation, and he goes in, and Winchell is you know, very brash and very egotistical and kind of says, "Nice to meet you, Mr. President. What can I do for you?" And FDR looks at him quite seriously and says, "Mr. Winchell, I'd like your audience." And that begins a working collaboration for them. Winchell wasn't part of the inner press corps. He wasn't part of the daily briefings. But he then maintained a personal relationship with Roosevelt. And through Roosevelt's, you know, nearly three terms, became Roosevelt's biggest mouthpiece, biggest megaphone, biggest cheerleader, biggest champion. And at a time when Roosevelt was trying to turn the ship of state toward a war that had broken out in Europe, Winchell became suddenly very, very politically important.
Mm. I'm really struck by a quote that we hear from it's either from a column or a radio broadcast, I don't recall, but where Walter Winchell says flat out, "Franklin Roosevelt means more to me than any other man." I mean,
he was in love. I mean, he was completely seduced by Roosevelt and suddenly had this mission, you know, that we can look to figures today. And I don't mean to couch it in politics per se, but it's if you look at the job that a Rush Limbaugh or a Sean Hannity does for a Trump, or that maybe a Stephen Colbert or a Jon Stewart was doing for, or someone else was doing for an Obama, and you multiply that by magnitudes, okay, that was the kind of power that Walter Winchell had over a readership and a listenership in this country at a time when everybody was down in the dumps, and now we're down in the dumps, so one can understand the power of such a figure coming along and saying, "Hey, I'm for you. I'm with you. I'm going to fight for you, and I'm going to find out what's going on for the little man and little woman, Mr. and Mrs. America. I am your guy.
Hmm. And it's important for us to say that politics had played an absolutely negligible, if not non-existent, part in Walter Winchell's work up until this time. So the fact that he kind of takes up the banner of Franklin Roosevelt as he does, and so forthrightly, it really marks a rather dramatic departure from what the focus of his work had been up to this time.
He's just an apolitical guy. I mean, he just doesn't really care or know or dabble in politics. When he meets Roosevelt, he, you're right, changes 180 degrees, turns 180 degrees in terms of domestic policy. What's interesting about Winchell is he is this guy who was born in Harlem to a Jewish family and sees himself culturally, though not observantly religious at all, and seems to have in him a real dislike, a real hatred for both fascist government and Hitler in particular. And he doesn't hold back.
One thing that we have not mentioned that occurs just before Franklin Roosevelt's election to the presidency occurs the year before, 1932. And this is the trial of Bruno Hauptmann, and that is the man accused of kidnapping and murdering the baby son of Charles Lindbergh. And one of your guests calls this trial the trial of the century, and whether or not, in fact, it deserves to be called that, certainly it was a momentous occasion in American history, and nearly all eyes of America were fixed on this particular event. Explain to our listeners about Walter Winchell's very intriguing contribution to the coverage of this dramatic trial.
Well, if not the trial of the century, it was certainly the very first media trial of the century. I'm just looking at a book about the Bruno Hauptmann trial, and what you see are the tripods on top of trucks with cameras on top of the tripods, where newsreel cameramen, invaded both outside and inside the courtroom. It was the first time that cameras were allowed in the courts in this fashion. The front rows of the court just behind Hauptmann on trial and his wife and his attorney are the Winchells. The Winchells and the other reporters who are there in the second row reporting on this thing. And it's just bigger than life. It's bigger than OJ. It's bigger than the kind of media spectacles and circuses that we all spend too much time on today. It was something that just captured the imagination the way nothing before had done. And Winchell uses it as his own trial to be taken seriously as a reporter. And he uses some of the wonderful friendships he's made with both people like J. Edgar Hoover, who was then the new young head of something called the FBI, which was relatively new at that time. And Winchell also had an awful lot of other sources. Winchell was friendly with Al Capone. Winchell was friendly with other underworld people. And he had this ability to swim across all strata of society. And Winchell was great at reporting gossip, but he was even greater at holding on to gossip, so that when J. Edgar Hoover, for example, who is there at the trial in New Jersey, tells him something and then tells him not to print it, Winchell waives his choice. Does he break a story and go first for sure and burn a source in J. Edgar Hoover? Or does he do what he's told and trade on it for more information later? He chooses that road, and it serves him very well the rest of his career.
One thing that we have not talked about yet is Walter Winchell's own personal life. And he goes out of his way to, the words of one of your guests, boasts about a wholesome personal life, when in fact his personal life is far from what he projects to the general public. I think it's better for us to leave it to our listeners to hear a lot about this as they watch your film. But maybe just touch on the troubling matter of, let's call it, hypocrisy, in terms of the gossip that he trades about all kinds of other notable people, while at the same time veiling some of the sort of darker facets of his own personal life.
Well, I'll tell you, as a filmmaker, it was a tough call, and my hand was forced by my very good editor, because his personal life is rather sordid and not the kind of thing I thought American Masters and PBS would be interested in going into. But you raise the word hypocrisy, and that's what it becomes. My editor and everybody who comes to the story cold. It's like, here's this guy. He trades on the secrets of others. He divulges the infidelities of others. He specializes in rumor mongering. And yet, suddenly, this guy, who has lots of dames on his arm, who freely goes out to the clubs, particularly a club in New York known as the Stork Club, and is seen with lots of women, with lots of starlets, but claims to have this, you know, wife and family at home. And so how that story plays out as his story and his professional trajectory go on is something that my editor wouldn't let me ignore. And so we do come back to it, and it becomes a theme in the film that's surprising, I think.
Absolutely. I want to also mention something that I found quite intriguing, and this comes up in the midst of the discussion about his personal life and how for probably most of his professional life, the family that he had was rather seriously neglected by Mr. Winchell, because he was forever in search of the next big juicy item for his column or his radio show. As you're describing his ferocious appetite for ferreting out this kind of material, you tell us something about the way in which he would spend many late nights around Manhattan in a specially equipped car in search of the latest bit of gossip. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about. I find this fascinating.
Well, at first you don't understand how he can do it. I mean, he's this, not just a brand, but he is this machine, this juggernaut that churns out a column 6 days a week and a radio program on the seventh. And you got to begin to wonder, does the guy never sleep? Yeah, you know, how does this guy do it 24/7? Well, it's not that he never sleeps. It's just that he takes some cat naps. So his daily routine becomes interesting to us because it starts at about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. That's when he wakes up. Then he has a quick breakfast around 6, 7 p.m., heads to the barber shop. After that, he does his work at the clubs and is there way past midnight. But then does he go home? No. Walter Winchell is both lonely, he's driven, he can't quit. I mean, he's a guy who just drinks too much of what he calls giggle water, but it goes down like coffee in his case. And he stays up all night and starts chasing crime stories with the cops and just really becomes so prolific and so part of everyone's daily life that we sort of go through the day with Walter Winchell telling us what's happening. It's a tremendous and tremendously different than now set of circumstances.
Hmm. By the way, you tell us that at the peak of his popularity, he commanded the attention of 2 out of 3 Americans. And that really says a lot about his significance at the height of his powers.
Well, I think if you take Oprah Winfrey and Jon Stewart and Rush Limbaugh and many, many, many more and roll them all into one, you begin to think about what Walter Winchell meant. So what the film does try to do tremendously is help myself and my audience understand the man and the origin story of what today is so fractured, happens so many different ways through social media, whether it's Daily Beast or BuzzFeed or CNN, Fox, all of the above. You know, it's just really something hard for people who are younger than I am to figure out that some one person could have had that sway over that much of the country. And it was fascinating for me to look at. I didn't realize it either.
Hmm. By the way, how much of Walter Winchell's radio legacy survives? A lot of your film, I believe, we're told nearly a quarter of the script are actually his words, many of them actually spoken by actor Stanley Tucci when we're being treated in a sense to the words of his column. But I believe we do have some legitimate excerpts from his radio broadcasts that are part of this film as well. How many of those survive, and where does one find something like that?
Well, you ask a thorny question, because the truth is the words nearly all survive, and yet none of the recordings, very few of the recordings, about a dozen total, including the day of Pearl Harbor. So while Winchell is this incredible figure, unlike other masters portrayed on a series like American Masters on PBS, Winchell has none of the output, the plethora of films or songs or other material other than his columns and his radio scripts. Now, something happened. In writing a wonderful biography about Winchell more than 20 years ago, the great biographer Neil Gabler found a number of radio scripts and early columns of Winchell. And he went to all the usual sources at the very end of his work to try to have those donated to some of the finest journalism schools in the country, starting with Columbia in New York, University of Southern California, and found no home for them. No one wanted them. And eventually, Winchell's family, little surviving bit of his family, put his earliest scrapbooks on the auction block. So what Neil Gabler, this author, had done was he bought the earliest scrapbooks, which contained all the radio scripts, okay, which had really never been seen before. And he donated them to the Billy Rose Collection at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center. So suddenly there was a trove of Winchell's words to be mined along with his columns. And the trick then, the challenge for us as filmmakers was to say, how do you make these words come alive? I mean, when you read them, they're stunning. But who is going to read them? And Stanley Tucci, who is a fine, fine actor, who had portrayed and won an Emmy for portraying Walter Winchell many years back, had that cadence, had that staccato, but had also built a friendship with the families of two of Winchell's ghostwriters and maintained those relations. And when I started doing research, it was they who put me in touch with Tucci. And, you know, luck happened, and we got him to sing the words of Walter Winchell. So that's how that came about.
It's a wonderful contribution to the film. And by the way, Whoopi Goldberg is the main narrator, and she also does wonderful work. I would not have necessarily imagined her to be a great choice to narrate an American Masters documentary. Her work is superb. So I love the way this film looks and sounds and is shaped. We have just a couple of minutes to talk about Walter Winchell's downfall. And in some respects, it begins with ill-fated attempts by Walter Winchell to go on television. That proves not to be a medium for which he's all that well-suited. His radio program does not transfer well to the TV screen, but it is really the way he attaches himself to Joseph McCarthy and a couple of other missteps, if you will, that lead to a very rapid fall from grace. Just in the last minute or so that we have, tell us what lessons there are to learn from Walter Winchell's rapid fall.
Well, I think there are different lessons for different people. You mentioned Whoopi Goldberg, our narrator, and I agree with you. She's not the first or obvious choice to narrate a film about Walter Winchell for American Masters on PBS. And yet when I talked to Whoopi and said, why are you even doing this? She said, when I was a little girl, in my family, the story of what happened to Josephine Baker meant a lot. So Walter Winchell had run-ins with lots of people, and Josephine Baker was a black international star who was one of those. And the legacy of that story, which we tell in detail in the film, will mean one thing to Whoopi Goldberg. Other people know Walter Winchell as the basis for a film called Sweet Smell of Success with Burt Lancaster. And it's a wonderful portrayal and a mean and biting and cutting portrayal and a terrific film. Other people have not heard of those first two, but remember Winchell as the voice on a different television program. So he means lots of different things to lots of people. People who have just seen on HBO The Plot Against America, based on Philip Roth's wonderful book, will recall that Winchell is a minor but pivotal character. And that story, and we thought suddenly, oh my God, there's an audience for people who understand this tension in the country, the tension between Lindbergh and Roosevelt that Winchell gets into the middle of, but don't really know the story of who Walter Winchell really is. And that's what we set out to tell.
It's a fascinating story. It's beautifully told. And the film, again, is titled Walter Winchell, The Power of Gossip, the latest installment in PBS's marvelous series American Masters. And the writer, producer, and director of this film, Ben Loderman. Ben Loderman, I loved the film, and I was so glad to have this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Walter Winchell, The Power of Gossip, airs tomorrow night on PBS Channel 10 in Milwaukee. Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program. With her will be Joshua Brown from the Wisconsin DNR. We'll be talking about the important Impacts of Wetlands and Wetlands Restoration and Mitigation. We'll have a conversation about Foxconn and that development and what that means for wetlands, and we'll talk about the Meacham Road wetlands development happening in Mount Pleasant right now. It's exactly 9 o'clock. Support for the W.